You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Julie Tibbler.
Thank you for tuning into Author Stories. We have a fantastic show for you today. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com where you can subscribe to the show on your favorite podcasting platform. You can find links to it there at HankGarner.com. I'd like to tell you about some sponsors before we get started today. The Clockwork Detective, Constable of Aquiline, Book 1 by R.A. McCandless. Aubrey Hartman left the Imperial battlefields with a pocket full of medals, a fearsome reputation, and a clockwork leg. The Imperium diverts her trip home to investigate the murder of a young druid in a strange town. She is ordered to not only find the killer, but prevent a full-scale war with the dreaded Fae. Meanwhile, the arrival of a sinister secret policeman threatens to dig up Aubrey's own secrets, ones that could ruin her career. It soon becomes clear that Aubrey has powerful enemies with plans to stop her before she gets started. Determined to solve the mystery, Aubrey must survive centaurs, thugs, and a monster of pure destruction. You need to check out this exciting new series from R.A. McCandless, Steampunk Meets Urban Fantasy and The Clockwork Detective. The Zombie Road Omnibus, The Roadkill Collection by David Simpson. Buckle up, it's gonna get bloody. Get the Zombie Road box set featuring the first three books in the award-winning Zombie Road series for over 1,100 pages of action-packed, suspense-filled, post-apocalyptic fiction. Includes Convoy of Carnage, Bloodbath on the Blacktop, Rage on the Rails. If you're looking for an apocalyptic thrill ride filled with everyday people, heroes, villains, and a dog named Bob, then look no further. Full of thought-provoking ideas that cover uncharted territory in post-apocalyptic fiction, this series will keep you rooting for the good guys, despising the bad, and turning the pages until the very end. The Zombie Road Omnibus, The Roadkill Collection by David Simpson. Homefront, an Expeditionary Force audio drama special from Craig Allinson. A full cast performance of a thrilling new episode in the New York Times best-selling Expeditionary Force series. After the latest mission of the starship Flying Dutchman, Earth is safe, not just for a year, but for hundreds of years. The ship's weary crew wonders what they will do with their lives in the peacetime, but the enemy has other plans, and there's danger on the home front. Starring Zachary Quinto, R.C. Bray, Kate Mulgrew, Robert Picardo, and everyone's favorite AI, Skippy the Magnificent, alongside a full cast. Includes plenty of pew 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 original sound composition and maybe some singing by R.C. Bray. Homefront, an Expeditionary Force audio drama special by Craig Allinson. Now stay tuned for the show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Julie Kibler on the show with me today. She has a fantastic new book. It's called Home for Erring and Outcast Girls. This is one of those books that we've all read books that we really like and we enjoy and we recommend to others. And then there's one of those books that kind of sticks with you afterwards and becomes a part of your consciousness in some way. And this is one of those books. Home for Erring and Outcast Girls is out everywhere now. Welcome to the show, Julie.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to have you. We begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
That's always a good question. I was always a reader, pretty precocious reader and talker, according to my mom. So I don't know if I had so many words that I needed to write them down instead of making everybody nuts with all of my talking. I loved to read. I loved to write. I had a lot of teachers that encouraged me to write. It seems like that was kind of my gift from an early age. And so I don't know that I thought I would necessarily be a writer by career, but I knew I would always be writing, if that makes any sense at all.
Yes. Yes, it does. I love that you had a lot of encouragement from teachers. I love to ask people about that because, you know, the dark, lonely days of writing can be a struggle for a lot of people, and some of those early encouragements always come back. And I like to encourage people to find someone in their life to encourage in the same way.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you weren't necessarily sure about a career as a writer, but it was going to be a thing that you were going to do. Do you remember one of the first stories that you wrote, or maybe something that you wrote that stuck with you, that you knew that you had maybe turned a corner in your writing and that this was something that was going to be bigger than you thought?
I would say, I was always, in every job I had, I was always trying to get the tasks assigned to me that involved writing, or, you know, later on website building, things like that. But so I was kind of a late bloomer as far as allowing myself to think about writing fiction as a career. And I would say that I went to the La Jolla Writers Conference. It's been a while. I'm trying to remember exactly when. It's been more than 10 years and probably closer to 12 or 13. And I had taken, you know, of course, different material with me. I didn't have anything finished, but I did a couple of read and critique groups with various authors and other readers, and I felt a lot of a little bit of buzz in the room when I would read things, and I had a couple of comments from some of the authors, and it was very I'm just at a loss for words right now. That always happens when you're a writer and you're
of course.
There was one specific moment when I went to get a book signed by Linda Lael Miller, who writes things that are very different from what I write, but I've kind of had a connection with her, I think, on a personal level and a reading critique. And I went to her to have her sign one of her books, and she signed something like, "Julie, you are a very, very talented writer. You're going to go places." And signed it. And then she told me personally, and I don't just write that to anyone. And so that was a very affirming moment. That was the word I was looking for earlier. I would say that probably was kind of a turning point where I felt like I might really have something.
Had you written any novels before your first book came out that did not get published?
Yes, I did. In fact, that conference, I had taken a middle grade book that I'd been working on for a critique with one of the children's agents that was there, and it wasn't complete. It was just something I was kind of playing around with, and I had started a few things before that I didn't quite, you know, I didn't finish them. I didn't feel quite like they were something I wanted to show anybody, and then after that, I wrote a full manuscript, and I, you know, went through all the kind of standard having beta readers and my critique group, et cetera. And then I queried that one, and I didn't query it for a long time. I probably sent out 25 queries and wasn't getting the kind of feedback that I wanted. And so I had started thinking about calling me home. And at that point, I just said, okay, I don't think this is going to be the book. Some people might think that's nuts after only 20 queries because you hear stories of, you know, hundreds. But something was just telling me, move on, go ahead and write Calling Me Home, which I did. And then, you know, with that book, I got an agent almost immediately and sold almost immediately. So obviously that was the right move. But bits and pieces of things that I start, fiddle with, and put away, you know.
Well, and that's so many people's experience, and that's why I asked that, because almost everyone has at least one trunk novel, desk drawer novel, you know. It's just part of, you know, working on your chops. Mm-hmm. But I do want to ask you this. The middle grade book that you wrote, and, you know, you queried 20 agents or so, was there something about the feedback you were getting that let you know that this was not the right path for you, not the right book? Well, was there something that stood out to you that bolstered that opinion that it was time to move on?
So actually, it was an adult novel. The middle grade novel I never queried other than doing the read and critique with the agent. And honestly, I think I was just putting off writing an adult novel because I honestly don't know that I would ever be a good children's author. I was kind of having fun with it with my daughters at the time, reading it to them. They were enjoying it. And I think I was just kind of taking a break. But the adult novel that I did finish, I was getting good feedback from people that were reading it, but it wasn't like overwhelming feedback. You know, it just was like, oh, this is good, this is solid, you know, from agents. I didn't quite connect with it, you know, kind of the standard stuff. And so it just didn't feel, I wanted more than that. I wanted an agent to, you know, jump up and down and say, can I call you tomorrow? Which is more what happened with Calling Me Home, you know. So, and then also when I finished writing Calling Me Home and had my critique group reading it and, you know, other people, I was getting texts in the middle of the night. I was getting texts, you know, or phone calls and emails and just from the readers before I even queried it, saying, this is it, this is it, you know, and I never got that with Calling Me Home. And so that was such confirmation that I had made the right decision. And I don't know, I just felt like I needed to put the other one away. I even sent it back to my agent after Calling Me Home to say, you know, should I pursue this anymore? And she was like, you could, but you're probably going to have to rewrite most of it, you know? And I was like, let's move on to something new. And it's a story I really love that story. It was, I would say probably the main reason I put it away is because I figured out more who I am as a writer. In that book, I wanted to be Jodi Picou. At that time, everybody wanted to be Jodi Picou. You know, it was kind of a rip from the headlines thing. And, you know, and then I was like, oh, wait, I'm not Jodi, I'm Julie, you know. And
Yeah. Well, one thing that I love about your books, Julie, is that you have this way of, and I want to talk to you about this because it seems like mining situations or personal family history or local history. There's something about the way that you take these kind of mundane stories, and I don't mean mundane in a bad mm-hmm. way, but like the things that all of us have in our past, in our families, or in our communities, and find the extraordinary story that kind of gets lost in our day-to-day, you know, histories. Can you tell me about Calling Me Home and where the idea for that book came from? I love that book. It's absolutely fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
Where did it come from?
So with that book, I talked a lot to my dad by phone at that time, and still he lives clear across the country, and so you know, we have to spend time on the phone, you know, trying to make up for the time we don't get to spend together. So I was taking this voice class with Barbara Samuel. She also writes by Barbara O'Neill and Lark O'Neill, and I'd had a conversation with my dad about his childhood with his mother. Was a we weren't very close like I was with my other grandmother. She was, she could be fun and she could be not fun. And I really was puzzled by her personality. So I asked my dad one day, you know, as an adult, you know, why do you think grandma was the way she was? And he said, well, he said, she told me one time that when she was young, she had had a relationship with a black man and that she wasn't allowed to be with him. And obviously her family didn't accept that. And she, it was almost like she was living a life that she didn't expect to live. Like she never got to fulfill that relationship, you know, what she, who she wanted to be with. And she had just kind of been living another life the rest of her life. And, you know, whether that's really the reason, you know, that she was unhappy or, you know, not who she could have been or not, that explained a lot to me. I felt like I had a lot of grace for her as an adult that I didn't have as a child when I didn't understand. So in Barbara's class, we were supposed to write a monologue from, and I can't remember what the specific instruction now was, but I decided to write a monologue from the voice of my grandmother. And, it ends up being nothing like calling me home, but it kind of gave me a glimmer of, this could be a story that I might like to write one day. And, didn't give myself permission to do that for a long time. But then I finally did. So.
I love it. Was it an easy story to connect with emotionally, knowing the family connection that you had and starting to think, of all of the fallout that happened to someone as close to you as your grandmother? Does that make it easier to kind of mine that emotional, or is it easier when you're thinking of some, like with your new book, you didn't necessarily have a relationship with anyone from the home for erring and outcast girls. Easier, harder, different. How do you see that?
I would say it was definitely easier with Calling Me Home. Isabel doesn't turn out to be really anything like my grandmother. I don't know what she was like as a teenager, but I could kind of imagine. But even so, Isabel took on a life of her own, and I'm not even really sure she is that much like my grandmother would have been. But definitely having that kind of personal connection. My dad also had told me that the town where he lived growing up and then the town where my grandmother lived were sundown towns, which I had not even heard of. He'd just never talked about these things with me. So, learning that about even my dad and my grandmother, and then also the voice of Dory, who was the hairstylist, and she's a Black woman, single mom. And I had a very dear friend and my hairstylist who was a Black single mom. And when I wrote the book, I knew that I wanted to do it from the, two voices, a white person and a Black person, because it seemed silly to write a book about race from just the white point of view if I was going to have two points of view. So lots of personal connections there. And it really did kind of rush out of me. Once I really got my feet steady in the story, I wrote it very quickly. And then I turned around and revised for about the same amount of time. Whereas with Home for Erring and Outcast Girls, which is a long title, but I love it. I found a kernel of, there's this cemetery in this town where I've lived for 25 years and I've not heard of it. What is this about? And then going and doing tons of research at the library. And I really started with different voices. I wrote the proposal, which went, through my agent and then eventually through my editor, several times from different voices, different situations. And, it was really a matter of finding the right, I always say I have to find the right entry point when I'm working on a novel, for it to really take off. And sometimes it takes me a while to find my entry point. And if I'm working on something and I don't find it, I move on. Like after several tries, I just never find the right, thing to jump off of, I will move on. So, this book was much more difficult to write. Absolutely.
You talk about that kernel of the story, and so many times that's how a story begins. It's just a thought. It's just a what if question. It's it's just something provocative that for whatever reason jumps out. I really don't like the question, you know, where do you get your ideas from? Because we know that ideas are everywhere. You know, you just have to open your eyes and ears, and there are ideas for stories everywhere.
Right.
But there's that story idea that just rises above the rest and floats a little higher. What was it about this idea, and what was the historical event and setting that inspired this to begin with?
Okay. So after I finished Calling Me Home, I'm going to back up a little bit. And the book was published, and I was, you know, attempting to write another story. I have told people this, and they just kind of look at me like, oh my goodness. I started or worked on 9 other stories. I didn't.
That makes me feel so much better about myself.
I didn't send, I didn't really try to sell any of them except for, I think maybe, so I went, my editor saw 2 of them, but that it wasn't really like, you know, do you want to buy this? It was more like, what do you think? You know? And she was like, on one of them, I'm not sure that's the right way to go. And on one of them, she was like, well, you know, that sounds good, but that sounds really challenging. And I'm not sure that that's the right thing, but go ahead and work on it. You know, so I did, but then I put it away. And then, so I just was kind of wandering, you know, I was doing a lot of book club events for Calling Me Home. I was doing a lot of events otherwise. And, you know, finally had to kind of, my agent was like, okay, I think you need to, you know, stop and really try to settle into a book if you want to have another book, you know? So, finally, after all of these other attempts, and I was really sunk pretty deep in another story, when I happened to see, a link on Facebook that a friend had posted, just, more of an acquaintance, somebody I don't know really well, but has been an acquaintance for many years. She posted a link to a story, an article, more or less, blog post or something, about the 10 most haunted places in Arlington, Texas, or something like that. And I was like, oh, that's interesting, because, you know, I'd lived in Arlington for 25 or so years. My kids grew up there. I had moved away recently from Arlington to Fort Worth, which is just, you know, 20 minutes. But I was like, oh, I know all of those places. I'm sure I know what all these things are, but it just caught my attention. So I just read down the list, and I'm really thankful I read all the way to the bottom, because the last one was the, what they said, the Lost Cemetery for Infants. And I was like, what is that? You know? So I read about it and, started to look it up. Like, what is this? Found out that there was this home on what is now part of the University of Texas at Arlington campus. There's a park there, and in a corner of the park, there is a cemetery for what was once a home for young women who were either pregnant out of wedlock, or they were prostitutes, or they were drug addicts. And this it was a pastor and his wife. They had built this home for these young women to come to and stay and find new lives. Basically, they didn't cover up anything that had happened. They wanted them to basically embrace their past but make a new life. You know, it was a place they could go to start over, but without hiding their secrets about their life. You know, if they had babies, they were actually expected to keep them for at least a year. If they were pregnant, they were, you know, they signed a contract saying, I'll stay here with my baby for 1 year while I learn, you know, a trade or anything like that. So I had never heard of this home, and it turns out so many people haven't. You know, I've only come across a few much older people who even knew that it existed. And so when I learned that, I was like, wow, you know, this is big. It was there 30 years. Lots of people went through this home, you know, and how come I've never heard about it? So I was just, I mean, my blood was pumping, you know, when I learned about this, I could not get enough, you know, the information was like, just, I couldn't put it aside, and I couldn't stop thinking about it day and night.
The, I've heard of places like this. And I remember, let's see, I was a kid of the 70s and 80s, and I remember earlier in my childhood that of a young woman who got pregnant out of wedlock and went away.
Right.
And, you know, almost a year later, she's back, you know,
right.
and nothing had changed.
Right.
And you know, after that, things started changing. But I do remember that. And I remember that this, you know, this kind of concept was, you know, was kind of prevalent in society, especially in the South. What I really find intriguing about this is that they try to remove the shame from that, you know, because people went away out of shame and then, you know, came back and just everybody, you just pretended that it never happened. And it's really provocative that they encourage these women to kind of own their mistakes and that to build a life in spite of those mistakes, or maybe, you know, with those mistakes, however you look at that. And as you started digging into this, what were some other provocative things that jumped out at you?
Well, so the history of that home, actually, from what I can read, there were 30, let's see, I have to do some math, 30, almost 30 years of what they called their journals, or they were basically like a, almost like a magazine, like a glossy, but not color, but, you know, a glossy black and white small magazine that they called a journal that they put out each, almost every month, that had a lot of information about the home. Basically, you know, it was a fundraising tool, but it was also an outreach tool. They would send them out to their subscribers, and, you know, subscribers would send money. The guy that ran the home was a really effective fundraiser, and that, you know, they did manage to run the home for 30 years. And, but the eventual demise of the home actually is because there a couple of other homes for unwed mothers opened in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and it, you know, they were following kind of the norm of you know, the babies were put up for adoption, the girls went and stayed, and now of course those homes are still there, like the Edna Gladney home, the girls can stay there. They get to choose, you know, whether they are going to keep their baby or give their baby up for adoption. So it's, of course, it's a completely different scenario now, but apparently they just really couldn't compete with these homes that wanted girls to give up their babies. You know, it became the fashion. I don't know if again, or, you know, maybe prior to that, girls just, when they got pregnant, they either, had the baby and lived in shame, or they, you know, went out, were mostly probably thrown out on the streets. And so it, I think it was actually almost the initial purpose of a lot of these homes, you know, that eventually did come around in the early 20th century, were for women to be able to keep their, I think they were kind of pioneering in that, but I think that wasn't as unusual later on. But then, you know, we get into the, oh, let's keep this a secret and your life can go on just like it did. So that was interesting to me, that it's almost backwards. You know what I mean? Like, you would think it would be the other way around, that, you know, the home would come after that versus before that. But it's like they went from, you know, being fairly open to suddenly, oh, secrecy is better, you know. I learned so much in the University of Texas at Arlington has a special collections department, of course, and they have this collection of memorabilia from the Baraka Industrial Home, which was the name, the official name of the place. It gets called As you're reading through the memorabilia, the newsletters, et cetera, you know, it's like the Baraka home for the redemption and of airing and outcast girls, you know, various things that they kind of used, I think, informally. And Baraka Industrial Home was the formal name. But I just learned so much in this very small but deep collection. There's, you know, three boxes, some microfilm, and then, of course, little bits of things here and there online. And my mind was just blown by so much that I learned. I feel like I'm wandering here, so you might want to get me back, focus me back in.
What you mentioned that you, while you were looking for the entryway into the story, that you'd done all this research and you're just talking about the archives. When did you finally find your inn? And with a place with a rich history like it did that was there for 30 years, how do you start finding the things that will, you know, launch the story for you?
Okay. So, I would say there was an entry point almost immediately, but I didn't quite understand it for a while. So I went to the cemetery, on my very first visit to the special collections department to, you know, look at the collection, kind of get my feet wet a little bit. I went to the cemetery and there were just a couple of the, headstones and memorials that really caught my attention, and said, you know, what is this? What does this mean? What, there is a story here just simply in the words that were on the stones that I saw. And that piqued my interest. You know, I knew that I wanted to write something about this home, but the gravestones piqued my interest in a much more specific way. But I didn't know what they meant. And so at first I was just writing, you know, kind of jumping off of that, like making up stuff, so to speak, you know, completely. And then the deeper I got into researching in the collection and, you know, doing other things online, looking at censuses, looking at, genealogy sites, I began to learn the real stories and found two young women in particular that just grabbed me. Maddie and Lizzie, who are the two points of view in the past on this story. There's also a point of view in the present of a librarian who is, you know, researching. She goes to work at the library and begins to research in much in the same manner that I did, only obviously didn't work at the library. But Maddie and Lizzie just, so I had, you know, I'd written a couple of other things. In fact, I sent the proposal to my agent several times and my editor had moved publishing houses in the meantime. And so it was, you know, going to be tricky. Whatever we did was, you know, new and we didn't know if I was going to still be at my other publisher or move on to the new one. But when I finally hit upon these two young women, who were real people that lived there, and I realized how much there actually was about their stories available, I knew that that's, you know, that was where I was going. With calling me home, you know, the characters live and breathe in my head, but they're not actually my grandma, they're not actually my hairstylist. They're just people that appeared that are fictional, but still live and breathe. Well, Maddie and Lizzie really were real people. And so if you take the living and breathing fiction character up a notch and know that they were real people, I feel as if I know them so much more intimately even than in Calling Me Home, and care for them and love them, you know? I'm obviously very passionate about them.
Yeah. Well, I love the framing story with Kate Sutton, and I love that you made her a librarian, and you know that's kind of one of those guilty pleasures for writers. We love to write about writers or bookstore people or librarians, you know. It's so much fun. Did you feel like Kate Sutton in some ways was a mirror of your experience in that Kate was kind of learning about this and uncovering and discovering a lot of, in the same way that you were?
Yeah, very much so. And also not only in that way, but so I have never worked as a librarian other than I do have a Master of Library Science and I did my internship at a library, but I mainly did it because I thought I would work as what they call an independent information professional, which I did for a couple of years and then moved on to writing full time. But so, I mean, I have, and I also tell people that when I was a little girl, I would catalog my books and make my friends check them out and I would find them if they didn't return them on time. And it really was just one friend. So she, you know, she was allowed, we moved a lot. And so it seems like I always had like one close friend and I would allow them into my library, you know? So, and my books were very much, they were the constant, you know, I carted my books everywhere, every move, you know, my parents didn't make me get rid of them. So we just moved them and I still have, I would say most of them, but, I also, in the story in Homefearing and Outcast Girls, Kate comes from a conservative, religious background, and she is beginning to really question things. You know, the girls in the past in the book, they're kind of coming away from lives that didn't necessarily have a big religious influence into this life where they actually have a lot of rules and, you know, policies they have to follow. And they're expected to be, you know, become, you know, conservative Christians and, you know, it's kind of a little bit opposite and not so much because Maddie is also a questioner, but Kate in the present has come from this background where she's, you know, been told this is that's right, that's wrong. You know, everything. And she's questioning it and she's having experiences that are causing her to really question everything she's learned. Well, I also come from a background similar. My dad was a pastor, and but, you know, fortunately, my parents were very progressive with my family. My brother and I weren't, you know, we weren't required to go to church. It was our personal choice, you know, but we were active in youth groups and, you know, we observed kind of kids in much more strict homes, et cetera. But I was also a questioner, you know, and my parents were very open to that. So in a way, I was like Kate in certain areas, in some ways different. But, you know, definitely much of that comes from my own personal experience and also the experiences that I observed of friends and people that I just knew, you know, so there's a lot of really personal history behind all of that.
Right. This book took you, you talked about writing the previous book and how fast that it came.
Mm-hmm.
And this one was more work for
oh, yeah.
you. Do you have any advice for people that find themselves in that situation where they know that this book is the book that they should be writing? They know the story has legs and the characters are real, but sometimes it just, you know, you, for all sorts of different reasons, you get mired down in the story. How do you work your way out of that?
Well, I would say you have to realize that every book you write is going to be different. Some books are going to rush out of you, and some books are going to, you know, make you think you're going to lose your mind before you're done. And that's normal. Some of them do and some of them don't. I would say in this case, I was so fortunate to have an amazing editor, Hillary Thiemann, who was at St. Martin's with me for Calling Me Home. And then I was, you know, fortunate enough to be able to move over to Crown with her for this book. And in fact, she is now with Valentine, and she said, hopefully you'll be with me at Valentine. But, you know, of course, those are both Random House, Penguin Random House. So that's a little bit easier move. I'm already there as long as I can, you know, give her another book. But and as long as she's still there. So hopefully that's a long term thing. But she is a tough editor. You know, we went through a lot of revisions with this book. Even after I had written and revised so much. And in fact, a lot of this book was written very quickly. Once I get started, I really am a fast writer. It's just a matter of getting to the right point. And then it just honestly gushes, but it still was hard. You know, it was very different. But we went through, I would say, 3 pretty intense revisions. You know, we'd hoped that it would be out last year, but both of us, you know, when it was all said and done, we were like, nope, it's not ready yet. None of us, my agent, my editor, Hillary, you know, we didn't want to put something out that wasn't ready. And so I'm thankful for the patience of my editor and also my own acceptance that, no, we don't want to just put a book out that's, you know, okay, we want it to be really good. And, you know, I hope that now that it's out in the world that, you know, that people agree. I know that not everybody will like your book, but I have gotten a lot of really good enthusiastic feedback. So hopefully we did our job with that.
Well, the care that you took really shows in the pages. So I think that's the ultimate, encouragement that you did the right thing, because it definitely shows through in the pages, and you know, some books just need more time, and I think we need to not be afraid to do that.
Yeah, and of course there's also the flip side. Like, you could fiddle forever with a book, and at some point you do have to just say, okay, we're done. And I'm a fiddler, so I don't know if you read the advance review copy or the finished copy, probably the advance, the galley.
Yes, the galley.
So I'm that person that even in the first page pass, first pass pages, second pass pages, I'm still changing words. So I think that I don't think I managed to make any big changes in, you know, from the proofs to the finished copy, but I know there are a lot of words and, you know, a few little mistakes that early readers caught, thank goodness. But yeah, it's still, I feel like you could probably read the final copy and it might be a little bit new to you. So, and you know, eventually people just have to say, okay, we're done, Julie, stop. I'm the person that gets charged, you know, they charge you, after a certain number of changes in your page proofs, they begin to charge you, because that, I think, helps you to let it go. And I think I got charged like $275 with calling me home. I hate
oh, that's
to see,
so funny.
I hate
oh, that's
to
so
see
funny.
How much I'm going to get charged with this book, because I'm just like, you know, a little bit of a perfectionist. So,
so everyone go out and buy the hard copy so that Julie can afford to pay back
sure.
the editing.
Yeah. even if you read the advance review, it'll be like you're reading a new
That's
book.
Right. Yeah. That's
I
right.
Think it's more or less the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the book is Home for Erring and Outcast Girls. It is available everywhere now in hardcover, Kindle edition, and audiobook edition also. Julie, I love the book. I love what you're doing. If people are just learning about you and want to dig into more about what you do, is there a place they can connect with you online?
Yes. My website, in fact, has recently been redone, and it's really pretty, I think. Author Bites did it. It's just www.juliekibler.com. My Twitter, I don't do much on Twitter. My Instagram feed, you can link to that, or my Facebook author page from my website. Those are the two places that I'm more active. I'm not a big Twitter person or Pinterest person, but I love Instagram because I love to take goofy pictures of my animals and you know, kids and things like that. So
love it. Well, we're going to send everybody to see you and to pick up their copy of Home for Erring and Outcast Girls. Julie, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thank you. I had a lot of fun.
Thanks for tuning into the Author Stories podcast. Be sure to subscribe at hankgarner.com or on your favorite podcasting app. Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
I was walking through the woods between Wolfert's Roost and the future site of my father's stone manor house. The house would eventually stand on what had been old Baltus's pumpkin field, the land where I had found my grandfather's head. Father had chosen the spot for its view of the Hudson River. Knoll was to be a grand mansion in the Gothic Revival style, but at the time the mansion was but a few foundations of Van Brunt stone. I had become fond of the place already, the idea of it, and I spent many a night alone in a shack on the property. My mother disapproved. She would have me sleep in the room across from hers in our townhouse. But I was 15 and did not answer to her. I kept a bottle of spirits hidden in the crook of two walnut trees near old Baltus's grave. I thought he would approve of the gesture. I had stopped along my way to fetch it out. At the moment the first pull of liquor touched my throat, I heard a ghastly, inhuman laugh. I was not alone in the woods. Had God sent the horseman after me? Had I sinned that terribly? I ran through the wood and found the field where Knoll was to be built. The outline of the foundations was barely discernible beneath the snow. An apparition stood there. Though I have seen him many times since, I shall never forget my first glimpse. Gaunt in moonlight, headless, exuding power and malice. A magic thing in the land of the ordinary. The headless horseman of Sleepy Hollow. What chills those words evoke. It charged at me, hatchet raised. I stood transfixed, unable to move, unable to even imagine escape. This was the servant of God, after all, sent to strike down sinners. I hurled the bottle from my hand, ashamed that I had become a drunkard as Baltus had been. It shattered against the foundations of Knoll. I stretched out my arms and awaited judgment. A piercing white light broke the darkness. The horse reared.
"Not my Dillon!" cried Agatha, appearing from the wood.
She held a skull in her hand. It shone brightly as a diamond, and in that moment I understood. The horseman did not serve God. He served my grandmother. Perhaps in that moment I came to see Agatha and God as one and the same. The unholy spirit fought her command. A foreleg of the demon horse struck my head with such power that I fell backwards with a cry and knew no more. I carry the scar to this day. A slight indentation in my temple, barely noticeable. In my days of courting, I was told that when I am angry, the patch of insulted skull bone will stand out in a disturbing manner. I have never had occasion to see this phenomenon, however, as I am generally well pleased whenever I pass a mirror.